I'm Dean Newland, and welcome to the Business of Intuition, where I coach, facilitate, train, and speak on the hard science and meaningful experience of intuitive leadership in business, so you can make better decisions, forge real connections, and creatively solve problems to amplify your impact and simplify your life. Welcome to the Business of Intuition. All right, I'd like to introduce our next guest, Catherine Halpin. Catherine and I actually met, I think, about a couple of months ago, if it was, my memory serves, through a
Susan Corbett.
Yeah, Susan Corbett Klein.
Susan Corbett
yes,
Klein.
Yes, right, another master certified coach.
Yes.
Catherine, I'll just kind of tee you up here, but wanted to find out more about your work. But I know that you are, or at least were, trained as a CPA and had a business in that distinction. Then you moved over to being a coach and eventually got your master certified coach distinction. I know they're inactive, but still, I think once you are, you always are. And I'm kind of curious, what was the impetus to move from being so deeply engaged in numbers and business to a completely different field in coaching? What was that like, and why did you make that shift?
Well, my dad was a CPA in Mississippi, and he shouldn't have been a CPA either. He was a people person, and I'm a people person. And so I pretty much did everything a CPA could do. I started in tax because of my background of working as a kid and a teenager in his office. And then I moved into internal consulting, internal audit. And then I moved to external consulting. It didn't matter which ones of those I did. It didn't matter if I worked for men or women. I just was never satisfied. I was never happy. And I frankly was not very good at it because I'm a people person. So I was looking for something different to do for about 5 years. And it took me a while. But in 1995, I heard the term business coach. And I said, what's that? Synchronistically, within a month, a magazine came across my desk with an article about Susan Corbett Klein being a career coach. And at the bottom, it mentioned Coach University. And I called the 800 number, and Thomas Leonard called me back in about 20 minutes. And I shared that story with him later. And he said, well, I probably would have gotten back to you sooner, but it's probably sending somebody a fax. This is in 1995 when we faxed everything back and forth. And he signed me up on the spot for his training program because I had been looking for a graduate degree program that I could do at night. And I had not been able to find one that I was interested in. I started an MBA program, but I thought this is just going to be more stuff I don't really want to know.
Those who don't know about the granddaddies and mommies, if you will, of coaching, you actually have some great pedigree to be able to work with Thomas Leonard. I mean, without getting into the deep story, but he was one of the founders of what we kind of now call coaching through Coach University. And then Susan, I know Susan, and she's actually been one of the people I've interviewed on this podcast, and she is one of the first master certified coaches. She helped start Coach University. She helped start the major organization that supports coaching. She created and helped co-found an organization called Conversations Among Masters. So you've got some great, great background. Congratulations on that. So what happened after that? How did that translate into a business?
Well, I told my spouse I was going to become a business coach, and she said, well, that's all well and good, but you got to keep your day job. And so I kept my day job. I was working as an internal consultant at that time and for 18 months. And Thomas's motto was you start coaching them right away. If they're alive, then they're eligible to be coached. And so I started coaching these micro-sized business owners and some random professionals, just people that I knew. We had not been in Phoenix, not even 3 full years at that point, but I did have a little bit of a network and the people I worked with. So I got clients and I didn't charge them very much. And I met with them on Saturday mornings at the Coffee Plantation, which was a coffee house in the Biltmore area. And they would line up. They would all sit at one table. They'd come over for 30 minutes at a time. And then as I got into the coaching, I realized, well, I don't need to meet with people face-to-face. I could do it over the phone. And Thomas said, you know, it's their life. If they want to take the notes, let them take the notes. Don't take the notes. And so I was taking my Coach U courses from people, instructors like Susan and all of her peers, and went to the first coaching conference. And when I came home from that, I said, that was in September of 96 in Houston. And I said to Bonnie, my wife, I said, if I can keep a portfolio of 15 of these small clients for 90 days, I think I'm going to give up my job because look at what I'm doing in the evenings and on weekends. And she said, that makes perfect sense. So in January of 1997, I went full time. And within about 6 months of that, I became a facilitator. I would say to the business owners these are complicated issues. And now I was getting clients with like 35 employees or 80 employees. And I'd say, these are complicated issues and you should not be making a decision in a vacuum. As much confidence as I have in my opinion, and I'm sharing that freely with you, I still think that you should involve your people. I said, so let's schedule an event, a meeting, and I'll facilitate that. So then I went from facilitating events to facilitating processes. And what I'm really known for is growing companies. I can increase shareholder value by 2 to 3x in a couple of years. Just, you know, I've taken $8 million companies to $25 million and $10 million to $30 million and $30 million to $90 million. And that's all because of just addressing the people issues that have been left to fester inappropriately. And so there's just these obstacles and silos and roadblocks. And I'm really great, because I'm from Mississippi, I'm really great at getting people to tell me stuff they shouldn't tell me. I'm highly empathetic. I'm highly intuitive. I'm just so gracious and encouraging and patient. And so they end up telling me way all the problems, all the stuff they shouldn't tell me. And then I'm in this very encouraging, safe way. I'm able to help them get that stuff out on the table and get it addressed. So I can help uncover corporate obstacles and turn all of them into opportunities in pretty short order.
So it sounds like these opportunities that you are tapping into are people related.
Yes.
Versus our business plan, our strategy, our mousetrap, our process, you're focusing on the people side of the ledger.
Yes. And now I do facilitate strategic planning and quarterly, you know, monthly or quarterly leadership team events, but it always gets back to the people, even if, you know, these strategies not being executed properly. Well, we have to look at those underlying people issues.
And I always think the same thing as what you're, I think, indicating is that there's a mirror between, or there's a mirror of the people side and the strategy side, that one sort of begets the other. If one's damaged in some way, it's going to affect the other side. As you look at the state of the union right now in business, and I know as this is being taped, we're going through a pretty big crisis with the COVID-19, but in general, what do you think are the key things that you're seeing in companies that are preventing that growth that you indicated before? What's holding us back on the people side?
Well, number one, I have an ebook called The Respond, Not React Playbook. And when I was a CPA, I was always in maniac mode. I was rushing from meeting to meeting, often coming in late to meetings, multitasking. And so as a result, I couldn't see the forest for the trees. I couldn't see the big picture, even though I'm a big picture person, if you look at my strengths profiles. So I'm passionate. And I think there's going to be so many gifts in this coronavirus COVID-19 crisis. And I think one of them is that people are going to get in touch with what's most important to them, their family, and being able to take a walk every day and have more time in their home to enjoy their home. And I think another one is that they're going to get out of that, some of the people are going to get out of that maniac mode, that frenzied state where they're overbooked and they can't think strategically and they cannot act strategically, and they certainly cannot be proactive because they're in reactionary mode. And I've been focused on this for the entire time I've been doing this work. What I've learned from what my clients experience is that when they get out of that reactionary mode, they feel like they have control over their destiny for the first time in their careers. So people are highly motivated once they see the benefit to, you know, to keeping those habits and practices in place. And those 9 habits are, some of them are from Coach, you had a personal foundation program, and it's still very much alive, and I refer lots of people to it. I think it's like a 90-day course. And one of the principles is to have reserves of time. And others are things like have reserves of money, have a strong community, have strong boundaries, high standard. And I had already in the 80s, by going to a lot of different time management trainings, I had already developed some habits. And even in the 70s, when I was still very young, I developed some habits, feel like I was getting out of overwhelm and feeling like I was grounded and on top of things and to really catch myself and coach myself. So I took all of those habits and I put them in my ebook. I did that in about 1998, but then I redid it a few years ago because I saw that meetings, the quality of meetings had really deteriorated in corporate America. And so I added a 9th habit about preparing for meetings and how to measure progress through meetings.
So it sounds like this ebook that you described here, it has these different habits kind of laid out. Can you give us a quick little summary, if you will, of your other book called Alignment for Success? And I breezed through a little bit, but I wanted to ask if you could kind of give us a quick overview about what's the main message here? What are you trying to tell us in this wonderful book?
It's only 5 short chapters. It's a 2-hour read. The first chapter is on the high cost of chaos and fear, trying to get people to realize, oh, this approach, this chaotic approach is really not that good, and it puts you at risk for fear. And so lots of stories about that. And then the second chapter and the third chapter, so 2 chapters out of 5, are about self-alignment. Bill George, the former CEO of Medtronic, says that when he saw a leader fail, it was never because they failed their team, it was because they failed themselves. They failed to be a leader to themselves. And that was my career as a CPA too. So I'm so passionate about that. So the first one is on mindset, and the second one is on your actions, getting all that aligned. And then the fourth chapter is on team alignment. How can you bring a team of people together and have them be a high-performing team and have them have a commitment to each other's individual success, not just the team success, because that's one of my definitions of a high-performing team. And then the 5th chapter is on organizational-wide alignment, because I have, for the most part, worked in very large organizations across the organization and can see how those silos and obstacles and roadblocks really impair people's effectiveness. And so that's on organizational-wide alignment. And none of it's rocket science. It's all just common sense, but it's not common practice.
So. Understood. Right. So with this situation that we're in right now, again, when people listen to this podcast, it could be, you know, 2021, 22, but there's certainly some lessons learned that we're going through that are going to be consistent beyond our COVID-19 crisis. But the question that I have is, given where we are now, how would you coach somebody to gain that self-alignment, that first step that you identified as being, you know, quoting Bill George again, we got to first be true to ourselves before we can start being true to the team and to the organization and so forth. We have to start with self. Right. And now we have all sorts of buttons being pushed. There's concerns about everything that has to do with survival in many people's cases. How can we, based on your background, your expertise, build alignment when there's so many things that are pulling us off that alignment? What are your recommendations?
I just have 3. The first one is to get out in nature every day. Something about being in nature and noting what the seasons and if flowers are blooming or they're not blooming, and is it cloudy or not cloudy. It's just something about that helps us be more grounded and helps us look at the big picture. And then the second one is to get your heart rate elevated. You know, neuroscience and biology tell us that when you get your heart rate elevated, you get endorphins released in your brain. So if you're feeling overwhelmed or you're feeling frightened or chaotic because you're working at home and you have young children to manage, whatever, or you've lost your job and you don't know if your unemployment benefits are going to kick in or when they'll whatever kick in, then you should get some exercise every day that elevates your heart rate. That alone is going to help you look at the big picture. And then the third habit that I try to encourage people to do is to take a look at my ebook. And the first habit is to arrive early so that you have time to prepare and think about the objectives of meetings or discussions. But the second one is to do a brain dump every day. A lot of people do to-do lists, but this is more comprehensive, includes family commitments, community commitments, networking commitments, business development commitments. And I ask people in my ebook to not just put down complete project XYZ, but to literally write down all the initial steps or all the steps involved in completing project XYZ, because then you have more realistic perspective on how long it's going to take you to get that accomplished. And more importantly, which ones of those tasks might you delegate to colleagues so that you don't have to do everything yourself. So because of my childhood in Mississippi, having to grow up fast and then going to work when I was about 9 or 10 years old in my dad's CPA firm, I had a lot of baggage. And that brain dump is, to this day, I rarely wake up feeling overwhelmed, but if I do, it's usually on the weekend, and it's not because of work. It's because of either social commitments or just errands or projects around the house. And so I'm like, oh, my whole weekend's going to be eaten up with all this stuff. And I'll just simply, open my phone before I even get out of bed. And in the notes section, just do a little brain dump of all the things I have to do. And then I can see it in black and white. When we don't see things in black and white, we make up stories about them. But when you get the facts in front of you, it's easier to be more rational and more, you know, reality-based. Those are the three things. Some of the nine habits, but especially that brain dump, especially if you're at risk for overwhelm, and then getting out in nature and then getting your heart rate elevated every day. Not complicated.
I love it. That's a great idea. Very simple, easy to remember. The brain dump thing I wanted to kind of tie into as well. I was reading a book many years ago. I think it's called The Power of Full Engagement. And it was really about part of this idea around getting the things that you're thinking about out of your head and into these lists to demystify them, because somehow holding on to them makes it a little bit more nerve-wracking. But then translate that into, when are we going to calendar that? When is that going to happen?
Right.
And then the real rubber hits the road. Was this really possible? Am I really going to be able to do this? Do I really have the time? It's like going back to accounting. Do we have enough money in the account to do this?
And money
becomes a metaphor for time. If we don't have enough money, aka time, then maybe we should schedule it for a time when we do have it. And it just all becomes a reality check.
Right.
So I love this idea about the brain dump. Another thing I'd like to ask you, Catherine, in as you listen to your clients, and your clients represent employees, clients represent stakeholders and shareholders and community members and all that out there. What's the sense that they're asking their leaders to learn that they need to learn themselves? What's the learning in the air that all of these employees that you are working with are asking you to learn or asking the leaders to learn that will help move us forward versus just keep doing what we've been doing?
I've been telling my technology company clients and professional services firm this direction, foosball tables in their lunchroom, tables, they have a lot of free food. And I say, that's all well and good. That's not going to hurt your employer brand. But what your people most need and want is to be successful at work. So let's sit down with each of them individually and help them, you know, be more successful. Ask them what they need in the form of resources or training or just questions, getting their questions answered about their projects. And to do that, to engage your people more effectively and more consistently. I have done a ton of work on that with leaders at all levels for 25 years, and nothing is more satisfying to me, because they'll start a meeting with me ranting and raving about some poor guy named Bob. He's an idiot. He doesn't get it. And I'll say, well, when was the last time you met with Bob? Oh, well, I never meet with him. He's an idiot. Why would I meet with him? And I'm like, well, you got to meet with him or take him off the payroll. Those are your two choices. And so Bob goes from being somebody that everybody thinks is an idiot to really being an A player in a very short amount of time. And it was in one conversation, they're feeling encouraged and engaged and empowered. And then they still feel safe to come up with ideas. Hey, I have a concern. I think this is a red flag and I've tried to raise it before, but I want to brief you on it now that we're better connected. I think this project has these three risks. And then to come up with ideas of, you know, be more innovative, to say, hey, I think we could make this process faster, better, smarter if we just tweaked it in these ways. So just to really engage your people more effectively and more consistently. Operative word there is consistent. You can't do that when you're running around with your hair on fire. So that takes like a little 3 minutes of prep. You know, what do I need to communicate with Bob? What are the questions I need to ask Bob? What do I think Bob needs from me? Let me vet that, validate that, see if that's right. So it's not complicated. It's just, the free food, that's all well and good too, but let's give people the tools to be successful.
And that's what you want to engage them in, are conversations towards seeing and feeling that success?
Yes, exactly. I want everybody to win.
Understood. Okay. What's your view in the future? What do you think as the companies go through this huge transformation crisis with COVID-19, how do you think we're going to come out the other end? What's the company of the future going to look like post COVID-19?
Well, I can tell you what my vision is. I do think that, you know, people are going to slow down and know more about what's most important to them and take better care of themselves. And I do think that a lot of companies are going to grow when we, well, they're already growing. Somebody told me last week, Microsoft is growing rapidly. They can't even keep up. So a lot of technology companies are already seeing the growth ahead of them. And certainly logistics companies. And I've been saying this for 5 or 6 years, every company is a technology company now because they're all so reliant. And now we're seeing just how reliant we are on the technology. So I think there'll be a lot more technology, and it's going to be easier to use, more like tablets than computers. And I think it's going to help us keep stay engaged with each other better. And I do think people are going to get clear that this whole maniac mode that they were in, expecting people to respond to an email late at night or on the weekends, it's just so unproductive. You can't see the forest for the trees when you're working, doing your work at 11 o'clock at night, or going through your emails or responding to emails or sending out emails. Just because you have an idea or a question doesn't mean that you need to interrupt somebody's evening or weekend by sending them an email. You can have a system to manage all that, you know, so you get out of your head so you can have a great evening or weekend. But why disrupt somebody else's? And then most importantly, why impair their judgment? Studies show now, Arianna Huffington in her book Thrive, she has, you know, empirical research that shows that people's judgment is impaired from sleep deprivation as much or more as it would be if you were a drunk driver. Your judgment is so impaired from sleep deprivation. So I think that that's going to be some of the big benefits that come out of this coronavirus. People have had a chance to see what's most important.
I read somewhere that prior to COVID-19, again, I don't know where the source was, 16% of U.S. employees worked virtually. Do you think that as a result of COVID-19 and so many companies now having to practice a virtual environment, that they're going to stick with it? And if so, how do we engage people when we don't have the opportunity to be in their presence and see body language?
Yeah.
How do we keep that engagement up when I'm going to look at you through a Zoom screen or platform, or it's a phone call, or I got 60 people on a conference call? How do we keep that engagement that you are so tied into? This is sort of your backbone, it sounds like, in your business around engagement, in that the world is going to maybe be more virtual. How do we marry the two?
Well, I think it's giving up the multitasking. If something's going to go south, a team or a project or a person at any level, there are red flags 6 years, 6 months, 6 weeks, 6 days before those red flags. But we have to stop multitasking and stop racing around from meeting to meeting. We may never, the executives may never be the ones to pick up on those red flags. But what we want to do is get our work environment so that people first feel safe to step up and speak up. And then third, so actually hear them when they say, I have a concern or I have an idea. So I think the virtual workplace is actually better suited for that, because if you're going to get on a call with somebody, it's human nature to just want to get your act together. Oh, okay, now let me put together, like, you know, my three agenda items, and let me ask them what their three agenda items are. That sort of thing. So I think it's going to lend itself to, I mean, the risk is it will multitask even more, of course, and there will be some people that do that, but that's not sustainable. They'll have a stroke or a heart attack, or they'll have to go out on disability for some other reason, or they'll, you know, get forced out because they're just generating so much chaos. It's not sustainable. It wasn't sustainable for me when I was running around like a chicken with my head cut off.
Yeah.
My hair on fire.
I think in some ways coaches have a unique perspective on a virtual work environment. You've started your coaching practice back in the late 90s. I as well did, you know, around 92. And there were years where I would be working with people and never meet them face to face. In fact, this was even before we had much technology around facial Zoom. Skype was not even around back then. It was all phone calls. And I remember people saying, how do you have a successful practice when you don't get a chance to meet people? It goes, well, I don't need to actually meet them. I can still hear nuance. And in some ways, I kind of liken it to being, this is not to be disrespectful, but kind of a confessional, you know, where you go and talk to your priest and say, here's what's going on. And so because I don't have those trappings of the nonverbal, I can hear different things, and maybe more so than if I were there seeing them face to face.
Yes, I totally agree. People feel safer. It's an anonymity thing.
Exactly. So I guess that's my little sidebar comment is I think that coaching and coaches can be an example of a virtual mm-hmm. environment and keep people engaged because we've been so good at it. I think primarily overall as an industry been pretty good at about keeping people engaged in a virtual environment because we've got such experience with it. So Catherine, like what's up for you coming up here in the next several months and years? Where are you headed?
Well, my wife and I go to Pagosa Springs, Colorado every August just to get out of the heat in Arizona and gives me a chance to reflect and think about the big picture. And last year I said to myself, said my 24th summer of doing this work, if I could rewind the clock, that's a question I often ask my clients. If you could rewind the clock, knowing what you know now, what would you have done differently? And, that's all about helping them take personal responsibility for, you know, how they've let some situation occur or fester. But I asked myself, you know, what would I do differently, knowing what I know now? And I said, I would start with a needs assessment. I would start every engagement, whether it was executive coaching, whether it was a succession planning or exit planning, whether it was to accelerate the growth of a company, no matter what the client wanted me to do, I would take the first 30 days and do a needs assessment and then help them come up with a plan of action to address those obstacles. Everybody's got the obstacles. The question is, can we get them on the table and can we put a plan together to get them behind us, turn them into opportunities? So that's what's next for Catherine. I'm in conversation with a number of people about that. Nobody has said to me, oh, Catherine, that's a bad idea. The question is, can the clients close those gaps and turn them into opportunities without me being there as a facilitator? Some clients have said they don't believe that that's possible. But I do think it's possible because in that 1 month short engagement, I'm going to give them access to all my intellectual property. So they'll have all the tools that they need. Sometimes people need the discipline of a coach or a facilitator, the accountability. And so, you know, we'll see how much, you know, how many clients need me to stay on after that in a second engagement. But my goal is to do tons of those.
Got it. So it sounds like this needs assessment, and I know you and I have talked about this offline, but is really, if I could summarize it, is to try to get to truth. Yes. What's going on right now? Where are the gaps? What's so right now? Because without that, how do we then build a future when we're moving around in the dark, so to speak, not sure where to go because we don't know where we came from? I think your needs assessment probably does a very good job of that.
Yes, exactly. And it also, it's asking people to, you know, score themselves against, you know, as if they were already a graduate of my programs using all my methods. So it's going to be a huge wake up call. Like, oh gosh, we didn't even know we should have been doing that. So I anticipate we're going to get some low scores, but that's going to uncover all the obstacles. And that's what I've been doing since I was 5 years old, turning the obstacles into opportunities and bringing order to chaos. So I'm very confident that that's going to be a really empowering experience for an organization.
A couple more quick questions for you, but you know, you started off this discussion around starting as a CPA, working with your dad. Obviously, maybe it wasn't the best fit because you're such a people person, mm-hmm. but you have that intellectual capacity to understand numbers, detail. You think in terms of process. You have this wonderful needs assessment that's really very much about clarity about what is. My curious question, I guess, now is how does your intuition, because you mentioned that earlier on, play a part of your process? Where do you move and how do you move from analytical assessment of this individual, this team, to moving into another space in your brain, which is intuitive, that may not necessarily have its root in a spreadsheet. What's that like? How do you balance those two out?
Well, again, I should have never been an accountant. It just really wasn't in the cards. And if I take any strengths profile today, it'll show that I shouldn't have been an accountant. But I have always been highly intuitive, and it's like movies are playing in my head. I tell the clients, if I'm facilitating a meeting, you know, then the movie is about their company. If I'm talking to one person at a time, then the movie in my head is about their life and their career and their role in the company. So I've very strong intuition, and it comes to me, you know, visually in my head. And then that allows me to ask people better questions. I had one client one time, it was a CPA. I've had a lot of CPA clients, and he had a small firm, but it was really niche and it was really lucrative, and he was doing really well. And he said, "You held a vision for my firm until I could get my act together and see that vision for myself." sometimes, you know, I think we don't have weaknesses, but we do get ourselves in trouble. And I think it's because we bring too much of our strengths. And I have had one or two clients over the last 25 years say to me, Catherine, you know, sometimes I think you want more for me than I want for myself. So there's always that risk too, because I get not attached to that vision, but so excited about the vision, so enthusiastic about the vision, about what's possible.
So if I could go back to this discussion around the seeing the movie in your head, the vision, the intuitive side of your skill set, because I'm thinking about the people who are listening to this and putting myself in their shoes to say, well, how do I become intuitive? What does that look like for me? You know, maybe I am an accountant and I'm good at it, you know, and I've been a CPA or I'm a CFO or what have you. And I know that I want to develop that intuitive side because it feels like there's something missing. Mm-hmm. For you, does it start with data? Does it start with facts? Does it start with the assessment, so to speak? And then because of knowing the current state, it morphs into something more intuitive, more visionary, or is the sequence different?
It's the opposite. So I'll start with the intuition, and then I'll, because of my background, I'll say, hey, what does your dashboard look like? And do you have any data about that? Or do you have an email that somebody sent you that we could use to, you know, share with the rest of the team about, you know, what's really going on here? So I start with a movie in my head, and then I'll try to validate it with what's, you know, current reality of the data. What's that showing?
Well, when does that movie show up for you? I mean, upon the first meeting, or is it somewhere after you've had a few interactions with somebody? I'm curious about how you get the spark of intuition, because some people have said, well, I first have to get to know them. It's really about pattern recognition of things they already sort of know. It's experience, it's understanding, it's data that then transports me into this intuitive side. But you seem to be saying it's the other way around. So I'm kind of curious, right, how soon do you get the intuitive hit?
In the first conversation. I do a lot of complimentary confidential consultations because I want to give people an experience of a benefit so that they can really assess for themselves. And I've done that continuously over the last 25 years. And I tell them, even if you don't hire me, it's going to be a powerful bonding experience. And people report consistently. They leave those first conversations with clarity, focus, and energy. And it's because it shows up in the first, you know, maybe 10 minutes or 15 minutes of those conversations. And, you know, again, like you said, we're over the phone for the most part, or now over Zoom. Sometimes I'm sitting in their office, but, you know, that's just if they're low convenient for me. For the most part, 85% are over the phone or over Zoom. And I think I'm better actually over the telephone, just because I've done it for 25 years. So I prefer not to go to their office. I used to have an office. I had two casitas behind my home for 17 years. And I had a lot of clients from Juneau, Alaska to Brussels, Belgium. People had traveled here to meet with me in that little, I called it my international conference center. But I think I'm more intuitive when I'm not looking at them, and I have to listen so deeply, and I have to, you know, be so present. I did a podcast interview 2 weeks ago, and I said to the young guy, he reached out to me on LinkedIn and said, I'm just trying to help authors promote their books. Would you like to do it? It was only 11 minutes. And I said to him, I think the best one, I was more articulate. And I said, and I think it was Christopher, because you were so present to me. So I think it's something about being able to be really, really, really present with people, and then hears things that they don't even know that they're saying.
This is great. When you feel that intuition flowing, and then you say the sequence is, now I go find facts and information to sort of back that up. Is that for you to justify, to validate, to build confidence in what your intuition is providing? Is it for you, or do you feel like it helps the client?
Oh, it's for the client. Yeah.
Okay, so it's really for them. Yeah,
for them to get grounded in the current reality, because sometimes people are in denial. And I've even worked with people who were delusional. And so we have to ground them in the current reality. No, I have a lot of confidence in my intuition. Now, there's a really funny story about this that's important. So I have never been all that intuitive about my own company. And that's what everybody says a cobbler has. It's very typical. So about 3 years ago, I said, okay, I'm going to take a course and I'm going to really develop my intuition. And it was a year-long course online. And it was not that great of a course, but once a month you got a call with a facilitator that would help you integrate what you had, the video had watched and the books that you had and the white papers or, you know, things that you had to write. And that was so powerful. And I started the 1st of February, and by April, so just a couple months into it, the facilitator said, you can forget about writing the papers. You don't need to write the papers, and you can do the courses work if you want to or not. But what you have to do, Catherine, is you have to relax. And she said, what's the most relaxing thing that you can possibly do? And I said, well, the most relaxing thing I can do is to read a really great novel sitting in my sit-up floaty in my swimming pool. And she said, how many times did you do that last summer? I said, I did it once. She said, I need you to do that 3 times a week. And I started relaxing at that level. And it didn't overnight. It was not overnight. But I definitely am getting closer to being due for the clients. Myself, what I do for the clients for 25 years. Much, 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 much powerful. I think because I have a history of being in mania mode, I never worked long hours as a coach. I felt like I had to walk my talk with my belief. And I haven't worked nights or weekends at all. I was still moving with too much intensity just because of my childhood trauma and of having to grow up so fast. I spent my career from age 8 or 9 or 10. I don't know exactly how old I was when I went into my dad's CPA firm, but very, very young. Until I was 35 is when I found coaching. So I was still bringing too much intensity. And circumstances conspired over the last 5 or 6 years to help me see that. Just relax. That's really what's going to work best. And then, then the result and my intuition of the helping companies has become so much stronger. So isn't that exciting?
So, all right, scenario here, Lorella role playing. Let's assume that I am a hard driving executive and I've got a lot of goals. I'm that maniac who's getting all sorts of stuff done. A little bit addicted to it too. It feels good.
Yes,
but I'm
right.
Also realize it's unsustainable. And I really am in a world of facts and information and data. Maybe I'm a CPA, maybe a programmer, who knows? But
right,
I have
MBA.
That personality. I'm an MBA, right? You know, and I've got a long, long line of successful career advancements and all that looks so good. Aside from your discussion here about relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
I love what you just said. Mm-hmm. What other things can those kinds of people do to tap into that brilliance to be more intuitive?
Well, it's the 9 habits. I'm going to, of course, encourage them to, they're probably already working out, frankly, because they're so, you know, goal-oriented. And so I'm going to encourage them to get out in nature and maybe even slow down a workout instead of doing an hour and a half of weightlifting, you know, maybe just walk your dog more aggressively, you know, so a little bit faster clip. But then it's the 9 habits because they're going to love that. You know, that's investing in themselves to bring out their own genius. So people are very drawn to those 9 habits because habits 7, 8, and 9 are what I call strategic think time. But you got to do the first 6 habits to create the white space on your calendar to be able to have the time to think strategically. And those are about how to solve a problem once and for all permanently by getting to the root issue. That's 7. 8 is about how to prepare to delegate more effectively because none of us are good delegators. And then 9 is what I call creative tension think time. Peter Senge coined that phrase. It's a gap between where we are and where we want to be. Well, that type A personality, that MBA guy or woman, they love that notion of thinking strategically. And they won't do that as soon as we hang up the phone, and they might not do it in the first week or first month of engaging with me, but they will be drawn to that. And then they'll see, like the exercise, when they don't get it, they miss it. And they'll see the nuggets, the genius level nuggets that come up. I'll say, I got an opinion about this, but what really matters, what is your intuition telling you? What is going to bubble up when you clear the space for your mind to really open up?
So just so we have it, just rattle them off. 1 to 9. Could you just tell us what they are? 1.
Arrive 20 minutes early. Even if you have people coming to you and you're not leaving your office for meetings, just have that 15-minute break. That's 1. 2 is to do the brain dump. 3 is to do calendaring. Even though we have these electronic calendars, sometimes they get screwed up. So it's good to look ahead like a day or a week or a month. That's where you start to let go of some things like, oh, I shouldn't even be in that meeting. Bob should go to that meeting. So you're starting to clear off stuff in off your calendar. And also it gives you a chance to think, oh my gosh, you know, three short weeks, we got our board meeting. We got to finalize our whatever agenda. So it gets you out of that reactive mode and more into that proactive mode. And then the fourth one is what I call commitments review. So once you have calendared, you know, it's all accurate and run your fingers through that, you run your fingers through your brain dump and you start to ask yourself, you know, who am I robbing of their professional development opportunities by not delegating more to them? What projects do I have here that could be done and who would be the best person to do them? And maybe not the whole project, but maybe steps 1, 7, and 14, you know, could be delegated to somebody. So that's where you start to get some real momentum and get stuff out of your calendar. Project work time is number 5. We all have things we have to do, even if we're the governor. You still have to be briefed on things. You still have to read things and ponder things. And to get that stuff in your calendar between, say, 7 and then 6 p.m. So again, you can free up your evenings and weekends. The stuff that we've, over the last, you know, 15, 20 years, because the technology became available, we just started doing a lot of the stuff that only we can do. We started doing that, you know, late in the evening after dinner or after our children are asleep or after our spouse is asleep or early in the morning when all those people are still sleeping. So to try to get that stuff done during normal work hours. And then the sixth one is the 5 P's for measuring progress and moving things forward in meetings. And then 7, 8, 9 are the strategic think time to problem solve, to delegate more effectively, and to close the gaps between where you are and where you want to be. So those are the 9 habits. Not rocket science, but all so powerful. So powerful.
There's so much out there in terms of information, but being able to have a concise step-by-step process is extremely valuable. So I really appreciate you being able to rattle that off. So how can people connect with you, Catherine, if they want to, as a result of hearing this podcast?
Oh, thanks for asking that, Dean. You're so generous. Well, my phone number is in Phoenix is 602-266-1961, 602-266-1961. Our website is Halpin, H-A-L-P as in Peter, I-N as in Nathan, halpincompany.com. And I'm all over LinkedIn and Facebook, but you do have to know how to spell Catherine. It's like Catherine Hepburn, K-A-T-H-A-R-I-N-E. Halpin, H-A-L-P-I-N. Yeah, so I'd love to be connected with your listeners and answer more other questions about the 9 habits or about my book Alignment for Success, bringing out the best in yourself, your teams, and your company, or my new assessment.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Dean. This was a joy.
Thank you for listening to The Business of Intuition. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about Dean or Mission Facilitators Leadership, go to mfileadership.com. That's mfileadership.com.